Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 3 of Hot Switch. I'm Sage.
I'm Kim.
And I'm Jen, and Jamie is out this week, so I am also Jamie, which is not
Jamie's
a stretch.
Jamie's also a monster.
Yeah. And she wants
we
you all to know
her because she's never going to hear this. So let's
She's basically choosing real life friends over us right now, so I, you know.
It's awful. All right.
Grossly offensive.
In a few minutes, we're going to get back into our romantic comedy discussion from episode 1 because we are not even close to finish. But first, we want to hit on just some quick things that happened in our world of fandoms, pretty important over the last couple weeks. And the first one is that the 12th Doctor... the actor who will be playing that part was announced in a live broadcast on, that was simulcast on BBC America. Thank you, BBC America. Yay, BBC America, last Sunday. And it is Scottish actor Peter Capaldi, who is 55 years old, and that's the same age as William Hartnell, the first Doctor. So definitely a shift in tone and character for the Doctor. I'll say first, like, his name was being bandied about a little bit by, it was like the bookies were saying that he had a really good shot of being the one chosen, and I thought, well, that's interesting. And then when they announced it, I was like over the moon. I did not realize how excited I was about him taking that part until it became a reality. So I'm psyched to have an older, more elegant, sassy, old
Silver Fox
Doctor. Silver Fox Doctor. Bring it on. What do you guys think?
I'm excited. I'm not really familiar with his work at all. I mean, since the announcement, I've watched a few of the things. Not excited. I think he's going to be sassy. I still, to this day, say he reminds me of Hugh Laurie. A lot of people are like, I don't get that. I'm like, well, I totally do. And I love Gregory House, so if he looks like Hugh Laurie, that's fine by me.
I know absolutely nothing about Peter Capaldi, except that my Twitter timeline was really excited that he's the new Doctor, so I chose my Twitter timeline, and I was talking to Kim, and I think he looks exactly like the child of Hugh Laurie and Craig Ferguson. And apparently, Craig Ferguson and him were in a band, like in the 70s.
They were in a band together. They're friends.
I can't wait until he's inevitably on Craigie Ferg's show, and they will nerd out, and it'll be awesome. Yeah. Can we briefly touch on the statement, though, that Stephen Moffat made about the potential casting of a female doctor?
Yeah.
And it was completely unnecessary of him being like, oh, I want the queen to be played by a man. You know, then the doctor can be played by a woman. And it's like, shut up. I refrained from using expletives right there. But,
well, it just confirms that I don't want... I would like a female doctor eventually, but I don't want Stephen Moffat writing her.
No.
I would like a female writer. How about a female writer to write a female doctor? I don't know.
Female writers on that show? Because they're on
about
that. But someone, I saw a tweet the day that it was announced, and someone said, newsflash, you are allowed to be both excited about Peter Capaldi taking this part and kind of disappointed that it's another white British guy. So we can feel that way, and that's how we're going to feel. But best of luck with him. He's awesome, and he's a big fan, so that's cool.
Yeah.
I'm going to move on to the next thing quickly. So Rashida Jones and Rob Lowe, the bomb was dropped by BuzzFeed a couple ago, are going to be leaving Parks and Rec after the 13th episode of this coming season. For once, we have a full season order before going in. The last few years, they've thought that episode 13 might be where the finale was ending, or even the series. But this year, we've got a full order. So there will be a full, about half of a season without Chris Traeger and Ann Perkins, and it is the end of an era.
It's
very, very sad.
It's so sad.
I trust Mike Schur in you know, every capacity, but it's like, what are they going to do without... And I know that Ann Perkins has been a bit of a problematic character as far as, like, defining her outside of her relationship with men and her relationship with Leslie, but I can't see Leslie going on without her beautiful tropical fish.
I know. I was actually the one to break the news to Jamie because I had found out, and she was just like, what? You know, same thing. I think that, you know, this is a good, it's a, I trust Mike, and he said that they're going to have a nice, really good, funny farewell, so I really trust that it's good that they have enough time to give them a proper goodbye. But, you know, it is hard, and, like, what do you do after one half of the pairing goes, and we're going to have the same kind of issue with Troy and Albert in Community this season, like, so that's something they'll have to figure out, and it's just,
they're going to lose, so we're losing Chris Pratt for part of that season as well, too, for Guardians of the Galaxy, so that also makes me think that this is going to be the final season, because everyone's got other projects percolating. I mean, the reason that, you know, Rashida's moving on, I'm sure, in addition to story, is that she's got development deals all over the place, and she's writing and directing, producing, and they're just taking off, so.
Yeah. And we know that Rob Lowe likes to leave shows after about four seasons.
It makes me happy that Parks is launching people into other things too. Like we talked about in our last podcast, it's great. So
I just know that come next May, I'm going to be curled up in the fetal position during May sweeps if it is indeed the last year of Parks, the last year of Community, and definitely it's the last year of How I Met Your Mother. So
we'll always have New Girl. That's about it.
Era, even though I had some people yell at me on Twitter being like, you're pronouncing Community dead already. And I'm like, guys, you know that I love Community just as much, if not more, than anybody else. But let's be real here.
Yeah.
It'll be a miracle if we get season 6. So we just got to go in prepared. Anyway.
Well, we are getting a season 3 of Sherlock. Eventually, it is happening. The wait is going to be over. They released a teaser trailer that is exactly 26 seconds long, and it just, this is why, just if you're wondering why the Sherlock fandom is totally off the rails, this is why.
This is why.
And I include myself in that. We get 26 seconds within, you know, a year or a year and a few months, and you're like, oh, thank God, the crumbs, and we get the crumbs, and we just have to take it. But really, the only thing that there is to say about the Sherlock trailer, besides the fact that it's out of control exciting, never even seeing a tidbit of it, is John has a mustache, and it's
that is about it.
He's ever seen.
That's the end. That's all. Yeah. That's all that matters.
That is literally all that we can say about the Sherlock trailer, is that John has a mustache. The end.
And Holmes is alive, obviously.
Yeah.
That's all that matters. Muppet.
We all just did the David Tennant Barrowman like gif at each other. Oh, Moffat.
Anyway.
And finally, one last thing before we get into our rom-com discussion is that Breaking Bad started its last eight episode run last night. And we won't say anything spoilery, absolutely not. I will only say that I spent the last about 3 or 4 minutes of that episode with my hands in front of my mouth and not breathing. I don't think I took a breath. So it's exciting.
I was that way for most of the episode, I felt like, from the beginning, like the first 5 minutes, and even though I had read a description of what was happening in the first 5 minutes, I was still like, my jaw was on the floor, and I was like, this is happening. And it's not.
Gilligan is the king of creating tension, and
it's not going to end well.
It's not.
I feel so out of the loop, but I feel so great because have never watched Breaking Bad, but I love. There's a little term that I've coined. It's like secondhand shipping, when you don't watch a show, but you kind of ship the characters because of how, you know, they pop up on your Twitter feed or Tumblr dash. I get secondhand anxiety from watching you all tweet about this show. I'm like, I feel so on edge, and I have no idea what's going on, but everybody else is, you know, freaking out. So I know everybody has theories, and everybody's trying to keep spoilers on lock, so we will.
I mean, I've been saying it for months, and this has nothing even to do with the episode, but I feel like it's all building to some sort of Shakespearean tragedy, and I've been comparing it to Hamlet, mainly because I was doing that even before. There was a photo shoot that Bryan Cranston and Aaron Paul did for EW where Aaron was holding a skull on Bryan Cranston's head, and I was like, yes, see, it's Hamlet. It's Hamlet, and it's all going to end, and there's one character that's going to be the last man standing, and he's going to be Horatio and goodnight, sweet prince, blah, 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 except, you know. So it's all going to be very scary and very awesome, and we've been told that we will not be disappointed, so keep true to that, Vince Gilligan. Please.
A lot of people are going to die. A lot of people are going to die. And there's going to be a lot of screaming from us.
From you.
Living bedrooms across America. So I think that's it. And we can delve back into out of meth dealers and, murder drug
completely
and Heisenberg, et cetera, et cetera. Back into the fluffy world of romantic comedies, which we all love so much.
Yay.
And I think wanted to start out this conversation by getting into the Julia Roberts canon, which we didn't get to touch on last time.
I feel like there's a Julia Roberts trilogy of romantic comedies, one would say, and they all three were on my list, and I was the only one to have two of them on there, I believe, because it's Runaway Bride, My Best Friend's Wedding, and Notting Hill, and they're awesome. But My Best Friend's Wedding was my number three choice. And again, I'm appalled.
Not Pretty Woman.
I'm appalled at all of you who say you love British stuff so much that I was the only one to have Notting Hill on there. You're all failures.
Look, I haven't seen the whole movie. I've seen parts of it.
How are you here right now?
It's on TV sometimes, but it's really, really long, and I feel like I've only seen like 75% of that movie.
Sage and I are so much older or whatever, but I do feel like the generational thing with the Julia Roberts movies versus, who we'll get to later, like the Drew Barrymore kind of things, you know, like, because Julia Roberts was the queen of the romantic comedy in, like, you know, the 90s and the early 2000s. And, yeah, I agree. And you'll notice also that we didn't include Pretty Woman in this discussion, because I personally don't consider it a romantic comedy at all. I think it's a little dark. It's more, I guess, a straight-up romance. I mean, sure, it has, like, all the fluffy awesomeness, and, you know, you always see on The Bachelor and stuff that they do the Pretty Woman date, where, like, he takes them out to go shopping and then gives them a diamond necklace, and I'm like, you guys do realize that you were basing this on the only reason she was getting all these clothes is because she was a prostitute and didn't have anything else, right?
they don't do the first Pretty Woman date, which everyone seems to forget about that movie. They think about the red dress and the necklace. They don't remember what happens the first night that he brings her back. Just
yeah,
saying.
Yeah.
She's worked for it. Bless her.
So
not a woman.
But My Best Friend's Wedding is my favorite of the three, for sure. And again, let's all side-eye Jen right now.
I accept it.
And when I was watching it, when I did the rewatch, when we were doing the whole compiling the list, I was very close to putting it at number two on rewatch, because I think it's got everything in it, but it's bittersweet, and its bittersweetness is what eventually made me put Sleepless in Seattle over it. But this is something that Jamie brought up in an email earlier today. See, we're not completely counting her feelings on anything. But what's great about My Best Friend's Wedding and about a lot of the, you know, more 90s comedies is they aren't afraid to villainize the heroine, because Julia Roberts is horrendous in My Best Friend's Wedding. Julianne is horrendous and is doing things principally to, like, break up someone's wedding because she thinks that she deserves to be with the guy more than the girl that he's marrying. And she does awful things. She's pond scum. She's lower than pond scum, to quote the movie. So that's why I love it, and I love that it has a real-life ending to me. It ends with, you know, the as it should be. And I thought that was a very bold choice. And I remember seeing it in the movie theaters, and I just sobbed over it, which my best friend that I was with, who was a guy, was like, why are you crying? And I was like, you don't understand. So
I think, you know, as that movie goes on and you think of him as this, like, the guy she could have had and this is what could have been, but what that movie also illustrates nicely is that Michael's kind of he's kind of a schmuck. Like, he doesn't really have enough imagination to be Julianne's life partner. They're good friends, but I don't think that he is her soulmate. So I think, to me, that ending is... it's not, I mean, it is depressing because she's alone, quotes, but I don't think you were meant to think, she missed out on the love of her life, the end.
Yeah, exactly, And it ends with her dancing with George, and, you know, by God, there will be dancing. One of the best last lines of a movie ever. Yeah. It really is. And now we've completely ruined everything for Jen, and she still has to watch it this weekend.
No, because I was having a conversation with two of my best friends, and they did tell me how the movie ended and how her character ended up. And I was like, oh, that's good to know. So, I mean, it's like you said with Jamie, with, like, the X-Files, you know, that's a 20-year-old show, 10-year-old show, whatever. You can't call spoilers on something that old. So I'm not going to sit here and call spoilers on my best friend's wedding. But I will say... that Jamie did make a really good point that made us think about older comedies versus, like, older romantic comedies versus newer romantic comedies. I can't talk tonight, which is really helpful when you're doing a podcast. It is interesting because what she said at her last sentence is, nowadays, the biggest flaws that you get in a romantic comedy are that a character is too clumsy or too focused on work. They're all about perfect people realizing they're perfect for each other now, rather than kind of having, like you did have in the 90s, in the late 80s, in the early 2000s, even these comedies about these people who were like flawed, who you didn't always root for. And I think maybe that is the problem that happened somewhere along the line. I don't even know where people just, suddenly they just wanted perfect people in perfect situations, but they somehow managed to find each other. And I think that's what I like about all of the Julia Roberts canon, is that she plays characters who are flawed and who you don't always like, but she does it in a very likable manner.
Right.
And I think maybe that's just her.
Even in Notting Hill, she does some really, like, dreadful stuff to Hugh Grant. She does some really awful stuff to him, and yet you still root for her and you kind of understand where she's coming from, and you still want them to be together because, like, their flaws together make them perfect. And Runaway Bride too, she has that whole monologue
exactly.
Of, I'm irretrievably screwed up, you know, and Richard Gere's
screwed up with her best friend's husband, and she knows that she shouldn't, and she does it to make herself feel better, but she recognizes it. And she can have, I love that conversation in that movie, because when do you have a best friend conversation like that in a romantic comedy where, you know, they can have that honest of a dialogue and say, like, I know you're my friend, and I know that you love me, and I know you don't do this to hurt me, but you do it, and you should be aware of it.
And the fact that it's delivered by the wonderful Joan Cusack makes it. She's the best.
She is the best.
Yeah.
So, having said that, and gone through, have we sufficiently Juliet? Does anyone else have any?
I mean, I think, Sage, you were saying earlier, over the weekend, that some of your issue with Notting Hill is the famous, I'm just a girl standing in front of a boy asking him to love her,
and you hate that part. I do. I love the rest of that movie. I think there are some sweet lines that unfortunately are not what people remember. But, you know, when they're in the park and she reads the inscription on the bench and the, but that line just kind of kills it for me. I love it, but I couldn't put it on the list, and it is entirely because of that line. Sorry.
Very interesting. Very interesting. And it is the line that gets parodied the most.
Of course.
Now, which means that it's, you know, great and had an impact on things, you know, like, you know, that's how catchphrases from movies catch on.
That's
so
true.
You know, it's Richard Curtis, who has a new romantic comedy coming out this winter, who he says it's his last movie. I'll believe that when I see it. I'm very excited to have someone writing a romantic comedy that we know has a voice for it. So hopefully he won't let us down. And it has Rachel McAdams in it, which is even better. And delightful other British people, including Bill Weasley. So
what?
Yeah, Bill Weasley and Bill, his real name is Domhnall Gleeson. I know his real name. And I saw the trailer for it, and I started crying. So hopefully it'll be good. And that is the end of the Julia Roberts, Richard Curtis conversation. Should we move on to Drew Barrymore? I know Jen has a lot of feelings about Drew Barrymore.
I do. And you know what's really funny? So we'll talk about Drew Barrymore, because I think this is kind of maybe, interestingly enough, kind of the generational gap of, we have like these women who are in kind of series of romantic comedies, and I didn't even realize how many Drew Barrymore comedies I loved until I started making this list and was like, oh, there are four of them on here. Okay, that's a pattern. But like, I remember clearly watching Never Been Kissed at a sleepover for the first time ever, and I fell in love with that movie when I was, like, pretty young. And it's just, I loved Never Been Kissed. The Wedding Singer was on my list. 50 First Dates was also on my list, and Music and Lyrics. And I think that Julia Roberts is to the 90s and early 2000s what kind of Drew Barrymore was later on, where she has this very likable personality, very likable way of acting, very believable. And I think I was trying to think of reasons as to why Drew Barrymore was on my list so much. And I think it's just because of that. I think it's because she makes romantic comedies real, and she makes her characters real. And whether or not they're completely, like, you know, like, Julia, or, you know, whether they're flawed, like, she just brings something lifelike to them, and obviously, you know, they're real, so they are alive, but she just brings some special element to whatever she's portraying. And obviously two of my movies on there are with Adam Sandler, which I also found surprising, but I surprisingly do like the Drew Barrymore, Adam Sandler kind of mini little arc with The Wedding Singer and 51st Date. And I don't know, I just really love, Drew Barrymore. I really love what she does, and I love the two Adam Sandler comedies, because they're kind of what you assume Adam Sandler comedies are going in, like, okay, they're, you know, kind of going for the easy laughs, whatever, and then they hit you with, like, a wave of feels about halfway through, and it's just, like, Drew Barrymore puts on an amazing performance in 51st Date. She's so good as, like, a comedic little love interest, but then she's, like, a really fleshed-out, developed character, and it kind of just hits you all of a sudden. And I think she was just kind of, at least growing up, I found that she was just kind of the most believable romantic lead to me, maybe. I don't know. I love
her. She has an inherent sweetness to her.
Yeah.
That, like, Julia Roberts to me has a bit of a bite.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
Drew Barrymore does not. And that's where they're different. You know, Drew Barrymore is always, like, to me, sweetness and light. And not that she doesn't bring, like, gravitas to her roles or whatever, but she's always, to me, very sunny, very sweet, very, I loathe to say it, girl next door, you know, someone that you really do, like, want to be her friend. You don't have to, you know, I think a lot of times today the studios are trying to shove some of these young actresses down our throats, being like, don't you really want to be this girl's friend? And you don't have that feeling of forcedness with Drew. You just want to be her friend.
Well, I mean, and yeah, like in Never
Who doesn't want to be friends with Julia Sullivan? Like, come on.
Her character in that movie, like, she, in Never Been Kissed, it's a much goofier, much more outwardly comedic Lucille Ball of a role, and then she can do The Wedding Singer, where she's really she's the straight woman in that, right? Like, she has funny lines, but she's not falling over things or dressing up in silly costumes. But she can pull off that comedy, and she can pull off you know, being just like a foil to Adam Sandler and all the other ridiculous people.
I think she grounds Adam Sandler too, which is why they worked so well together. Is like, because he did this after doing two of the greatest comedies ever, let's be honest, in Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. And so when Wedding Singer came out, it was something completely unexpected from him. And I think that was because of what she brought out in him. Like, I had no idea he was capable of being dreamy. Because he is. Robbie's a bit dreamy. And The Wedding Singer, like, the perfect guy that you want to, like, snuggle with.
And it's true, because you have to have that balance. Like, there is, it's not just about how great one of the actors or actresses is. Like, you can have the best actor or actress ever in a romantic comedy and have somebody who they don't mesh with. And it can be a terrible romantic comedy. And maybe we'll talk about that later if we have time. But that is so true. Like, I wonder why, like, I had to think about why is it that I have a repeat comedy on there with Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore, and it's because they find that balance. Like, Adam Sandler's over-the-top, crazy humor, you know, he's got, like, crazy storylines, Rob Schneider just thrown all over the place, random, and, you know, he kind of, you go for the easy laughs, same thing with, like, Click. And, like, every Adam Sandler movie has that. And then there's that surprising little bit of, you know, some sweetness and some girl next door, like you were saying, like, grounded in Drew Barrymore. And it makes it from going from something that could have been easily, you know, slapsticky, easily just kind of brushed aside as, like, a nothing comedy to something that actually has heart. And I think that's what probably, in my opinion, Drew Barrymore brings to everything, is that she brings this believable heart and soul of a character and a romantic lead to whatever she does. And, I mean, same thing in, like, Never Been Kissed. Like, I think we talked about it, you have to either want to be the romantic lead actress or know somebody who is, or want to be her best friend. And I think in that movie, like, we just all want to love Josie. Like, I mean, you just love Josie. You just...
Wasn't Josie Grossi a little bit?
And you just want her, you want every one of her characters to succeed. You just want the best for her, and I think that that's the mark of a great romantic lead.
Also, Michael Vartan, can we talk about him?
Yes. Michael Vartan as the dreamy English teacher.
I shouldn't say that because I'm a teacher. It's a little creepy. Don't get me wrong, when he thinks she's a kid, but
yeah,
we know the truth, so it's fine.
Yeah. Well, and we can also mention, since we've talked so much about the ladies, but, I mean, one of the common factors in several of the movies we've talked about tonight is Hugh Grant.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked about him a little bit with Bridget Jones's Diary last time, but he was the king of the romantic comedy.
Yeah.
So, more so
than... He invented that. That's good for him, because he had played the sweetheart and the... like, looking down at your shoes, awkward, bubbling Englishman who the girl fell in love with, and Bridget Jones brought out this great caddish character in him, which, that, at the time, it was new, and then afterwards we found out that he had a little bit of that in that.
Now, I remember reading, and I don't know if this is completely accurate, but I do remember reading that he kind of resented the fact that he kept getting cast in romantic comedies, and he wanted to stop doing them, and then he read the script for music and lyrics, and again with Drew Barrymore, and he decided to do that movie, even though he knew it was going to be a romantic comedy. And I love him in that movie.
He's fantastic. It's a bit, because it's a bit of the floppy Notting Hill guy.
Yeah.
Daniel Cleaver. Like, he's definitely got more of an edge in music and lyrics, and he's kind of caddish and, you know, but still, you know that he's a good guy. And plus, he sings all those amazing pop songs.
Yes, yes. And, I mean, I think that's what Hugh Grant always brings to his roles, is, like, that snark and that wit that makes you really want to wring his character's neck, like, in 2 weeks' notice. But also, you love him. Like, you can't not love his character.
You can't not love him.
Yeah. He's got this very, like, he's not necessarily, like, the dreamy, like, Josh Duhamel or anything like that, but he's the character that's kind of like we talked about a couple.
Hugh Grant is about 6,000 times dreamier than Josh Duhamel.
I was just about to yell at you about, really, Josh Duhamel?
Okay, that's the first person that came to my mind. I'm thinking about what Hollywood wants to cast now versus what they used to cast in, like, Grant. Like, obviously, we haven't really seen, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like music and lyrics is the last time I've seen Hugh Grant in a romantic comedy. Am I wrong? Has he been in anything else?
Probably.
Okay. No. Music and lyrics was like before 2008, because my earliest was 2008 and 2009. So back in the day, they used to appreciate the dreaminess of Hugh Grant, but now they think that the only way they can sell rom-coms is by throwing Zac Efron or Josh Duhamel on a poster for a Nicholas Sparks movie, but that's But yes, so Hugh Grant is fantastic, and you all should love him if you don't.
I really wish he would do something else with Sandra Bullock.
Me too. Yeah.
2 weeks' notice was so close. I almost had it.
Shame.
I'm surprised that no one had just before we leave Drew Barrymore, no one had Going the Distance on the list. I've only seen it more times. I maybe would have considered it, but I remember enjoying that film also, because she was with her on again off again boyfriend Justin Long, who I also find completely charming. It's sort of a grown up romantic comedy, I thought. No sort of silly pratfalls or anything like that.
I remember seeing that one and being like, oh, thank God. Like,
yeah.
they can still do funny, you know, romantic comedies that, you know, and it took a nice twist on the whole, you know, you really hadn't seen a romantic comedy about long-distance relationships, and I think it handled that one really well. So yay, Drew. Yay, Justin Long. So we do, you know, in our lists that we made, we all had ones that no one else mentioned, and so we wanted to take a moment to speak up for the underrated or the unappreciated rom-com. And Sage, do you want to take yours first?
Sure. I went back and forth on this many times, because I believe I have the most on my list that no one else has. Seven on my list that I'm the only one
who
put down. So I was going back and forth, and the one that I decided to talk about, if we only do one, is The Cutting Edge.
Yes!
Yes!
Yes! Topic!
And so this is my love of The Cutting Edge is very personal, because I was a figure skater for years, and I remember very clearly going with all my girlfriends from the skating rink and all of our moms, and we all went to see The Cutting Edge together. It was a movie about skating. I'd never seen a movie about skating before, because I was too young for the pain of ice castles. So that's how I felt about it when I initially watched it, but I keep going back to it. It's never gotten old to me. I never feel like I've aged out of The Cutting Edge, and the reason for that is because Tony Gilroy wrote that screenplay. Tony Gilroy, who wrote Michael Clayton and a bunch of the Bourne movies, this was his first Hollywood film, and it's a fantastic screenplay. It holds up. It's immensely quotable. Jamie's email reminded me that, you know, Kate Mosley isn't, I mean, she's not very likable for most of the movie. She's prickly, she's demanding, she's selfish, but it's because she is an elite athlete, and that's what elite athletes have to be like to get what they want. And so that pairing with her and D.B. Sweeney, he understands that because he's an athlete too. And he calls her on it. He calls her on it when she's being out of control, but he also respects that drive in her. And that's what's great about their love story of coming together is that she also had fallen out of love with her sport. She didn't love what she was doing. She didn't love skating. She was only doing it to get the medal in the box. And so once she has this person to share it with who makes her love it again, you know, it's a story about her changing and growing as much as it is about them falling in love. And also it's the Pamchenko. And that movie, if it has taught me one thing in my life, was at the age of like 8 or 9, I knew how to do a tequila shot. I didn't do that, but I knew how. Like the salt, the lime, the flip, I got it down. So, coming in.
I fully support that choice very, very much. Mm-hmm. And Sage and I, in our many G chats and tweets, have made a musical out of The Cutting Edge that would be amazing. And it's got some amazing song titles. You know, parentheses, all we needed was a little flip.
All we needed was a little flip. Topic.
Don't quit your day job. You've got a really nice sit spin.
Yeah.
It is, and I will say, and I remember seeing The Cutting Edge when I was in like junior high or whatever, and remember thinking it was one of the greatest movies I'd ever seen. And I agree with Sage in that it holds up completely. And the last time Jamie was in town, Sage and I sat her down and made mm-hmm. her watch The Cutting Edge, and it was awesome. And she was like, oh my god, I totally get it, you guys. So
another thing I'm being side-eyed for, so.
Yes, we are. We're looking at you very judgingly. But yes, I totally support you defending The Cutting Edge for being an awesome romantic comedy, because it is.
It is awesome.
I'll go in that I picked, and it was my number 15, but that doesn't mean that it's like, you know, the 15 least or whatever, but I find that One Fine Day is very unappreciated, and it's George Clooney at his George Clooney-est. It was like made in the middle of like his Caesar cut ER days, and he's so dreamy in it, and it's Michelle Pfeiffer, who never does fun movies anymore, and I feel like it's very in the style of some of the, you know, 1930s and 1940s screwball romantic comedies, in that it takes place in the span of a day. It's two grown-ups, which you never see anymore, you know, with real problems and, you know, dealing with childcare and jobs and, you know, being divorced and all that kind of stuff. And they come together, and, of course, they instantly hate each other, and then they become reluctant allies, and then they end up liking each other a whole lot, and it's just fun, and it's a romp through New York City for Parenthood fans. It has a little baby, adorable Mae Whitman. She's like 5 years old, and she's precious. She plays George Clooney's daughter, and she's absolutely adorable. And you know, up until, and I said this in my blog post about it, but up until like The Angels Take Manhattan happened in Doctor Who, I always associated the Bethesda Fountain with One Fine Day, because, like, George picks Michelle up and, like, runs with her through a giant rain puddle, and it's like, but in the end, when, how do you not squeal when George Clooney, like, looks at you and you're in the middle of an argument, and then, like, the best part is he's like, what would you do if I kissed you right now? And Michelle Pfeiffer and the whole audience kind of goes, what? And do you want to kiss me right now? I wouldn't have said it if I didn't. Like, that is dreamy, awesome romantic comedy dialogue, the end. You should rent it if you haven't seen it. I remember I saw it on my 17th birthday, because it came out in December, and I went with all my girlfriends, and we were all just leaving all a Twitter about George Clooney, and that's why he's forever in the Common Law Top 5.
That is amazing. I guess I'll go. I was waffling between what I wanted to choose, but we've already talked about some of the movies that were my my sole choices, including like the Adam Sandler, Drew Barrymore canon. So I figured I would pick one that is probably one of the most recent ones on my list and say I'm going to defend 27 Dresses because it is one of the newer rom-coms that I feel like actually worked. And it's one of the last ones that I feel like actually worked for me. Because Katherine Heigl made a good choice in this movie and in taking this movie. And I love James Marsden, and I love pretty much everybody who's in it. But I think that what I like more, obviously it follows very tropey things. Girl and boy meet, girl and boy hate each other. You know, one's a cynic about love and romance, and the other's like, you know, this wonderful plans all of her friends' weddings is you know, literally has been a bridesmaid 27 different times and just does and does for everybody else and never does anything for herself. And, you know, they hate each other, eventually start to like each other, fall in love, blah, blah, blah. But I think why I put this one on my list, and I can't remember if I talked about it in my blog post, but I probably did, is that it's a lot about, much like Never Been Kissed, it's about loving yourself, and that's what Jane finds in this movie. I think, apart from the romantic aspect of it, is that she finds out that she doesn't have to be a doormat to people, and I kind of relate to Jane in the fact that I do a lot for people, and I'm very much of a says yes to everybody person, and I kind of get taken advantage of sometimes because of that. And she's, you know, older sister always looking out for her younger sister, and she's got all of these character flaws that we don't associate as flaws. Like, we think Jane is a good person, and she is, but she's just as flawed as Tess. Tess is, like, really her, you know, her younger sister's very selfish, but Jane is so consumed with making everybody else happy that she never is happy to be herself, and that's just as flawed as trying to change who you are to please everybody else. And so I think that what I love is that, you know, James Marsden's character, Kevin, really teaches her, like, it's okay to say no to people. Like, it's okay to do something for you and to make you happy. And that's really what he says, like, in their kind of final confrontation before, you know, the end and everything's happy. He's like, I want you to be happy. Like, you deserve happiness. And I think that that's, like, the first time anybody's ever told that to her in the entire movie, even. And, you know, apart from all the humorous aspects, all of the cutesy little things and all, like, the love story, it's really a love story, like, it's a love story about Jane loving herself and learning how to love other people better because she loves herself better. And so that's probably why it ranks so high on mine, is because it's one of the few rom-coms, I think, that really went back to that root, like, later on in 2000, because this was 2008, I believe, and it's one of those ones that doesn't, it teaches, like, it's okay to love yourself, and you can also have the guy, too. Like, you don't have to have either or, so, I don't know, I love it.
No, so. I enjoy 27 Dresses. I mean, it is the one in the, it's a shame that ever since then, Katherine Heigl didn't ever say no to a script.
No.
Comedy, and did a lot of ones that have done a lot of damage. The Ugly Truth. I mean, you know, where there's a whole extended gag about vibrating panties, and that's what we think is, you know, good romantic comedy material. But I do enjoy her.
She said Knocked Up was sexist and misogynistic, and then she goes on to do that, whatever.
Exactly.
Judging.
I did not see either of, no, wait, I have seen Knocked Up. I haven't seen The Ugly Truth, and the only other Katherine Heigl romantic comedy that I've seen is Life as We Know It. Like, that's more recent than 27 Dresses.
Yeah.
And I liked that one. It wasn't like, woohoo. It just didn't have the same heart. Like, it was sadder, definitely, than 27 Dresses, but I feel like it just, she clicked with Jane, and then she just kind of went along for the ride with the other ones.
Well, I mean, yeah, me saying in my judginess of judging her is she got a little too between, because 27 Dresses came right after Knocked Up, and she started to think that, you know, she could carry a movie, and she got all happy being on Grey's Anatomy, you know, really starting to think she was too good for Grey's Anatomy, and maybe that's where I've had a lot of the problems with her since then, is because I've had problems with her as an actress and as a person. Sorry, Katherine Heigl, judging you haven't even met you. I'm sure you may be lovely, you may be not, but your tabloid behavior is atrocious. And so...
Love how you're speaking to her like she's going to listen to this.
Yes, you know, Katherine Heigl totally listens to our podcast, guys. Yes. She's going to, you know, give us a shout-out in her next movie when she does something good.
I get to name the characters like the mean girls after us.
Yeah.
I think we should all do one more because I think we have some time.
Yeah, okay. We do. Go, Sage,
okay.
Go.
Okay. Which one do I want
to
do?
Return to Me, please. Will you please talk about Return to Me?
Sure, I'll talk about Return to Me. Okay, so Return to Me not only was on my list, but in the top five, I think I have it at number four. I went to see this with my best friends in senior year of high school, and we became so obsessed that we would act out scenes from... We went to the zoo the day after the prom. We went to the zoo the day after the prom, and when we got to the gorilla pen, we were like, take a picture, and we made my friend's boyfriend take a picture of us putting our hands up on the glass, like Grace does to Sydney the gorilla, because he knows that Elizabeth Hart is in there. Okay, so anyway, it's a super cheesy premise, which is that the same heart loves him all along, but it's just a very sweet, old-fashioned romantic comedy with an amazing soundtrack, pretty sick soundtrack. The cutest old people on the planet. Grace works at her grandfather's Italian-Irish restaurant, where I want to work. And David Duchovny, who is forever in my common law top five, and he doesn't do romantic comedies. He really doesn't do romantic comedies. This is like the one that he's done that I feel like is a straight romantic comedy. And Minnie Driver is lovely too. And when I was rewatching it for this list, I realized that there's a part where, because, you know, Grace is afraid to tell. She's afraid to tell anyone that she even had a heart transplant. This is even before she finds out that she has his... Grace has Bob's dead wife's heart. That whole thing. And Jim Belushi's like, I'll kill him!
God. It's such a good movie. It's such a good movie.
But she is afraid to show him her scar. And she comes over and she's gonna like have this talk with him, and it's when she finds out. And his best friend is like, tonight's the night. And you realize that these people have been dating for months and becoming really close to each other, and that they haven't had sex yet. And there's no comment, there's no conversation that he has with his friend to say like, hey, come on, man, like, why isn't she putting out? Like, there isn't any conversation like that. And it's just sort of laid out there and not commented upon. And I feel like, you know, that's a little bit of old-fashioned sweetness that you wouldn't find in a current romantic comedy.
It's refreshing.
That I don't love a good sex scene in a romantic comedy. I'm not anti that, but it doesn't have to be in everyone. That's my defense of Return.
It's also directed by the delightful Bonnie Hunt. So
and co-written by the delightful Bonnie Hunt, who also plays the delightful best friend. Bonnie Hunt is amazing, and Jim Belushi is kind of like, according to Jim, but he's very great in that movie. He's really funny when he invites the priests over. Jesus Christ, he's just a man! it's just one of my favorites forever.
Sam?
It is really old-fashioned, and I do. It wasn't on my list, but I love that one. It's so good. I don't know I feel like I had a list with a lot of things in common, either with Jen and Jamie or with Sage. So and really the only other ones that I was the only one to have, we've talked about, which is Julia Roberts. canon. I will say a little bit more about Notting Hill as to why I love it and where I think it's great is it's also that wish fulfillment kind of thing, because we do go to the movies for a sense of wish fulfillment, and haven't we all the time wonder what would happen if, you know, our favorite celebrity walked into our office and, like...
No. I've never thought about that.
No?
Never. No.
No,
we don't have entire blog entries devoted to our TV boyfriends.
I don't know.
No, we're not going to do a podcast about that.
That's why I love it, you know, and it is, you know, sometimes we want realism from our movies and sometimes we want the pure fantasy, mm-hmm. and Notting Hill is pure fantasy that, you know, a movie star would fall in love with a common person and be delightful. And, like, one of my favorite scenes in the entire movie is when he takes her to his sister's birthday dinner. Mm-hmm. And his friends, like, treat her so wonderfully. And they're, you know, shocked that she's there, obviously. But and then they have that whole scene where they're going around the table talking about who deserves the last brownie.
Oh.
And, like, it's wonderful. And, they, you know, and it gets really real because they talk about their real problems. And then, you know, she pipes up and she's like, well, don't I get a chance to talk about it? And then she has this really moving monologue about, like, what her life has been like. And then, you know, right when it's teetering on the edge of being like, oh, poor Anna Scott, they put her in her place by being like, oh, nice try, gorgeous. You don't get the brownie. Really sweet. And it, like, it also, like, humanizes her right there. What makes her, I think, fall in love with Will is that she feels normal and, you know, that he accepts her for everything and not because she's the movie star. So, and you gotta love the end when, you know, he goes and to the press junket and gets her back, and then, you know, and Sage and I have experienced the press junket before, and it is a running joke with us that you are Horse and Hound's favorite actress, is what we say whenever we're in a press sort of situation.
And feel so, very out of place.
Can
we talk about Rice Ifans, please? Because
yes,
about this
Spike, the best roommate ever.
Unbelievable. The shirt that he wears for his first date.
You're the most beautiful woman I've ever seen. And then you turn around and it is like, fancy a fuck. It's amazing. And then when and he goes outside in the paparazzi and his, you know, tidy whities and poses. Like, it's a delight. That's also, I mean, the supporting cast in Notting Hill is delightful. It also has baby Hugh Bonneville for Downton Abbey fans. And, you know, when I went to London in college and we went to Notting Hill and to the street market that he walks through, and we definitely found the, you know, a house with a blue door, you know, speaking of doing nerdy things.
I went to the travel bookshop.
Yeah, took pictures in front of all the Notting Hill stuff because that's what you do. And so that's why I had Notting Hill so high on my list, because I had it at number 6. So that's my defense of Notting Hill.
Done. One more.
All right. Going through my list, I realized I was the only person who had Sweet Home Alabama on there, which is funny because I watch a lot of romantic comedies, I guess, for the first time at sleepovers, because I watched this at a sleepover back-to-back with Just Like Heaven. That's what it was. Uh-huh. It was back-to-back with Just Like Heaven. So it was like Reese Witherspoon Central. I love Sweet Home Alabama. I will watch it anytime it's on TV. And, I mean, I love that it's a story about this girl who tries to get away from her past, and that's, like, kind of what most of, like, movies encourage. Like, shed your past. Go towards, you know, you want the Andrew Henning. You're supposed to have the rich, famous, wonderful life, and she does, and then she goes back to where she came from, and it really humbles her because she's not, I mean, she's likable. She's a, you know, Melanie's a good character, but she's not the best that she can be. She kind of forgets where she came from, obviously, and she hates where she came from, and she resents her family and resents everybody who's still there. And, like, that scene in the bar was just, it's just so painful every time you, like, watch it, because you're just like, why are you so cruel to, like, all of these people just because they live in a small town and, you know, you think that you're better than everybody else? And she, you know, admits to thinking that she's better than everybody else. But what I really love, apart from Josh Lucas and Patrick Dempsey and Reese Witherspoon, is that the end of this movie does not villainize Patrick Dempsey's character, which it could have easily done. It could have easily been like, look at what you're leaving behind, and look at how terrible you're going to make, you know, her feel and all this. And he just kind of looks at her and he's like, yeah, I understand. And you get the sense that he cares about her throughout the entire movie, but at the very, like, at that moment, I was like, oh, he really loves her. Like, he's letting her go. Like, that's how much he cares about her. And so I just love I love everything about it. I think it's a really cute, fluffy movie. It has some really good heart. Like, at the dog cemetery makes me cry every single time I watch that scene, because I'm like, oh. She just, like, she, you can tell, and maybe that is what I put in my blog. It's like, that was the moment that Melanie was the most human, was when she didn't realize the human she left behind and, you know, cast aside. But the fact that this dog, who shows nothing but love, she left this dog, and it had no idea what it did wrong. And
you're going to make me cry.
I guess she breaks down, and she just starts, like, crying, and I'm like, oh, my gosh, Melanie. And then the, why do you want to, you know, kiss me anyway, you know, or why do you want to be married to me anyway? I'm messing up the line, and it's like,
so I can kiss you anytime I want.
Exactly. And I love the parallelism at the beginning and end with that. And it's just, it's a super cute movie. Reese Witherspoon is, again, one of the people who, like Drew Barrymore, I feel like has that, or maybe even more so than Drew Barrymore, has that very girl next door kind of thing, where she just is the sweet, likable, down-to-earth character in everything she does. And then, you know, obviously she's got this kernel of emotional story, and she's just super great in this movie. And everybody, all the cast is just great in this movie. And I love it, and it's always on TV, and I'll always watch it. So if you haven't watched Sweet Home Alabama, turn on the TV. It's probably on.
I really have a problem with the bar scene, though. I can't get through the bar scene. I can't. I only watched it once, and that scene upset me so much that I've never been able to watch it again.
Seriously?
I did not like her. I did not like her at all. I had, like, serious issues with her character.
She's not, and that's the thing. She's not super likable at that point, because at the very beginning of the movie, you see her as, like, a fashion designer, and she treats everybody well, like, because she's made it, quote unquote. And then, you know, she's obviously really sweet, and then she goes back to her roots, and it's like, it's so painful. And I always had an issue too with, like, her mother, the way that her mom treats her. It's like she wants her to marry Andrew because, not because she knows that she's in love with her, but because she thinks that she needs to get out of her small town. She needs to legitimately move and, like, shed that part of her past, which is what, ironically, she comes full circle and realizes, no, I'm not better than everybody. So at that point where she's ready to marry Andrew, she's completely, like, realized how the error of her ways and the fact that she's, like, not better than anybody else. But yeah, the bar scene is it's so cringeworthy, because it's like she's just being so unnecessarily cruel in thinking that how much better she is than everybody else, that you're like, why would you even like this person after this? And it's just, she does redeem herself, though, throughout. And that's why the dog cemetery scene just kills me so much, because you can see how vulnerable she is in that moment when nobody else is around, because she doesn't think that anybody's watching her, and obviously Jake is watching her in the distance, but it just kills me, that scene.
Plus, how can you be so mean to Ethan Embry? He's so cute.
He's so cute.
He's
so great. And Melanie Lindsay.
She was also drunk, too. So, I mean, we'll give her a little bit of a...
in that movie, too.
Melanie Lindsay is always precious. I want her to be the lead in a romantic comedy. I will see.
Totally. And I do appreciate Sweet Home Alabama for, you have a baby in a bar. I say that all the time.
Happens all the time.
Whenever I see a baby in an inappropriate place, I say that line.
Get your baby out of here.
Get your baby out of here. So, I think that is that. Does anyone have anything else to say about the rom-com canon before we leave it behind? go into new territory.
There's so many more to defend, but I will stop.
Give a quick shout out. Give a quick shout out, Sage, because you were the one person who put really classic ones.
Yes. Let me holler on my classics. There were a few that didn't quite make it onto the list. Philadelphia Story obviously is up there. It Happened One Night is considered to be the first by a lot of people, Hollywood romantic comedy. But the two I had on were The Apartment, Billy Wilder film with Jack Lemmon and Fred McMurray, and a very young and adorable Shirley MacLaine with a pixie cut. She's so damn cute. And then I also had Bringing Up Baby with Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. One of them is dark. The Apartment is pretty dark. Billy Wilder films are just tend to be dark. And if you don't know the story, it's Jack Lemmon is this sort of mid-level office drone at an insurance company, and he wants to climb the ladder, and so he will loan out his apartment where he lives alone to these executives above him who want to take their mistresses there and bang them. This is what this is about. He's fine with it. If he's going to, like, get his promotions by doing this. And Shirley MacLaine is an elevator operator who he's kind of sweet on, who turns out to be the mistress of his boss. And when he tells her that he is actually not going to leave his wife for her, like he's been promising, she tries to kill herself in the apartment, and Jack Lemmon finds her. This is a romantic comedy, I promise you. Anyway, Jack Lemmon is completely precious. There are very, very classic lines in it, including one of, you know, we were talking about there may not be marriage, there may not be sex, but there's also a really well-known final line in this movie, too, with Fran saying, shut up and deal. I think that's all I want to say about The Apartment. Oh, also, it is a big inspiration. Jerry Maguire is actually an homage in a lot of ways to The Apartment. And if you watch them back-to-back, you'll see just how strong that connection is. And, in fact, Cameron Crowe wanted Billy Wilder to play his agent, I forget the name of his agent mentor, that they will cut to, and he's giving him advice. He wanted Billy Wilder to play that part, and they were friends, but he declined. And then Bringing Up Baby is just a screwball comedy. It involves Katharine Hepburn being like a crazy heiress who is awesome, and Cary Grant being this very bubbling, nerdy paleontologist, and them taking care of a leopard.
I think that's all you need to say about that.
That's all I have to say about that. So yeah, watch the classics. If you haven't watched the classics, seek them out, please.
You can see the roots of all the movies we've talked about previously.
Right. And so many dreamies in those old ones. Like, I had no idea how adorable Jack Lemmon was. He is really cute, you guys.
And Cary Grant, hello, forever flawless.
Archibald Leach. He's amazing. What do you mean? It's really good.
Yeah. Yes, let's give a shout. I got to give a shout out to Tweeting Carrie. She sent me cookies today.
I am
sitting here eating the cookies and torturing Sage and Jen.
What are they? What kind of cookies?
Chocolate chip deliciousness.
What?
I mean, I've already eaten the peanut butter and bacon cookies, so there you go. So thank you, Carrie. You're amazing. And there's your shout out. I told you I would do it.
Let's just give our weekly shout out to Sean and Chelsea, because they've waited through like what, an hour of a podcast, and finally we said your names. Woohoo!
There you go. And Charles too.
Thank you, everybody who's listening. I'm gonna give a shout out to Jamie because she's not here.
And so she's a monster.
We're just gonna be proud. Talk about Jamie for like 30 seconds. Go.
She's the worst. The end.
Jamie is editing this and is probably going to edit it out anyway.
Yeah, it's fine.
Thanks
everyone for listening.
Thank you, everybody.
We'll see you next time.
Make sure to follow us on Twitter, podswitchpodcast.wordpress.com.
And thank you to Julietta for our lovely new logo.
Yes. Thank you so much, because it looks so pretty, and we look like we are super professional, because we are. Yes. All right. So we will see you guys when we have a new podcast topic. So thank you for listening.
Yay!
Bye. Bye. Yay.